Likewise.
Okay, will do. Today is Thursday, October 29th, 1992. This is Dan Austin. This is the second part of an interview with Bertie Tebbets. We are at his home in Anna Maria, Florida, near Bradenton. And Bertie, thank you again for inviting me to your home. And as we talked about on the phone the other day, that we talk about your role as a manager and with the Cincinnati Reds. And I think we'll just start right then and there. I'd like to start out with, well, this is the time of year when a lot of managers get fired, but I guess they get fired any time of the year. And I always heard that firing the manager isn't fair, but it's right.
And well, the thing that happens there, Dan, is when the guy takes the job, he knows he's going to get fired. So it's
he better accept it.
Late or not, that's something that's, he must accept.
Okay. Let me ask you, Bertie, before we get talking about the when you became manager of the Cincinnati Reds in the mid-1950s, that there's been a lot of stories written about you, talked about you. Do you have any thoughts about what has been missing, maybe in your baseball history that you would like to put for the record, that things written about you that you think are missing that you would like for the record?
I wouldn't. I think the record is has been covered pretty well.
Okay.
I think that in the lives of my ballplayers, the family lives, the different things that happen to a person unrelated to baseball, I think I had the image with my ballplayers of being trustworthy and dependable, and that I would help them with their problems financially, privately, family-wise, and everything else. That's a thing of which I may be the most proud.
So if they had a problem or they just wanted somebody to talk with,
The wives, too.
The wives, too.
You know, if they were having a little difficulty, they'd talk it over with me, mm-hmm. and I'd talk it over with both of them, or if it was something I didn't like about it, I'd bring in a counselor. Mm-hmm. A minister in one case and a priest in another,
mm-hmm.
and always the same, I'll not name them, and we worked out a lot of problems that I don't think are particularly noted today.
Those are the quiet, invisible things.
Those are the things I'm most proud of, mm-hmm. you know, bunting, hitting and running, but the thing I was... As I look back, I was so proud of the fact that if a guy or a girl had a problem, they brought it to me.
You say, here's somebody we can trust, and
yes.
we'll go no farther.
Yeah, that's right.
And sometimes they solve the problem themselves. Sometimes you may have offered some advice or maybe just been a good listener.
Yes. You know, if you catch a guy out after hours, there's a stigma attached to it, and people will read into it, mm-hmm. or if a guy gets in trouble, or whatever their other problem, if they know they can come to you and explain it, and you will accept it. Maybe find them a little bit in mm-hmm. cash, so that at the end of the year you can give it back to them somehow.
Oh. Okay. Bertie, it's often said that the best baseball managers were always infielders, and particular catchers, as opposed to outfielders, and certainly as opposed to those who became members of the Hall of Fame. And so behind the plate, you were kind of, I'll call the quarterback of the baseball team, and a lot of catchers have gone on up to be managers themselves. Well, you caught under some great baseball managers, and I assume that's where you learned a lot of the stuff about becoming a manager yourself. Who strikes out in your mind, or strikes in your mind, that who offered you the opportunity to learn that part of baseball?
Well, the first guy I played a full season under, a half a season under, was a catcher. His name was Bob Coleman. He was spent his lifetime in the major leagues and had a little exposure during the war with the Braves. He was a catcher, and he directed me pretty well. There was a situation where I needed some advice, and he gave it to me. I went then to Beaumont, Texas, where there was a catcher managing there. And I went then from Detroit, where there was a catcher managing there, Mickey Cochran.
Oh,
So that at one time in Torch Shores, I was talking to some writers, and they brought the subject up that you just talked about, and I said it's very difficult for a pitcher to become a manager because his back is to everything. He looks in and he only sees the catcher. And it's easier for the catcher to become a manager because he's the only one that sees everything. He sees how the infielders move and why they move, and he figures it out. And if Gehringer moves to his right and you don't know why, you ask him, and or why the outfielders gang up, and why the pitchers do what they're doing because you're the catcher. So that I said that in Shores, and 20 years later or more, one of the writers in New York, whom I was not a great admirer of, wrote me a letter and said, I thought you said managers couldn't manage. And Freddie Hutchinson had just won the pennant for St. Louis. This guy kept it in his head for all that length of time, waiting for a pitcher to win. So that there are pitchers now who are doing an outstanding job. And it's a different game now. And I just feel like the advantage is with the catcher, only because if you want an immediate fix, the catcher can walk in there and know exactly what to do technically. But that's only a small part of managing. You've got to manage people. You've got to manage front offices. And therefore, I would say yes and no. But more yes than no.
But rarely do you ever find an outfielder who becomes a big league manager because they're away from all the action and the conversations.
I suppose they if they get the publicity, they have to be a great ball player. And great ball players don't particularly like to manage. They have, but they don't really like it. On the other hand, you take an infielder who, like Alex Grammas, and a catcher like Torrey and Crandall, and you go right down through the they might not be great ball players. But they are attractive to people who want somebody who understands the game. I think for that reason, outfielders do not concentrate on managing, and the other guys do.
They kind of, if there's some conversation around the mound, they're still out there waiting until it gets over and the batter comes up. In our last meeting, you said that, well, at least when you were managing, that managing the stars of the team was the most important thing. Everything else fell into its place. What do you mean by that? Because I think you'd have to manage everybody because everybody wanted to be out on the field.
Well, you know, you can't put managing in a test tube. If you were going to do that, if you thought that there was a book on managing,
I would go out and buy it.
You would, yeah, that's right. You'd write it. You would say, well, Casey Stengel doesn't belong in it because Walter Austin is a different type of guy, and Lopez is mild, and Cochran was crazy. And you go, I don't mean crazy. I mean he was competitive. And you go all the way down through Danny Murtaugh and Eddie Stanky, and each one was a different type. But each one was able to handle a pitching staff, or he had to go home.
Tell me what you mean. Okay, let's take...
I mean that if you have the pitching, or if you can create pitching out of what you have, and you can get the trust of your entire pitching staff, then you can do the kind of a job that's supposed to be done. I think that you have to have meetings with your pitchers and catchers together.
Separate from the other team?
I believe that. And unlike the old days when they had meetings of the whole ball club and all you got in then was arguments and and outfielders knowing they're supposed to pitch a guy low and you pitched one high and a guy hit it. The outfielder came in and said, where was that pitch? You know, that's a fight. So that I would ask the pitchers at first, the catchers, because that was Cochran's and Lopez's style, and the pitchers then meet. And then if you have a pitcher who's been around for a while and you were talking about a hitter, you would say, how are you going to pitch to Stanky? And the pitcher would say, well, the first couple of times up, he tries to pull me. Mm-hmm. And when he's up and they need a run, he's trying for a base on balls, and he'll hit me straight away more than he will pull me. So if you bunch him in the outfield, I think I'd like it better, you know. A guy with a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, you know, what the hell, you pull him all over to the opposite field because nobody can pull him anyways. But I think that an experienced pitcher has the right, in spite of all of the statistics that are placed before him, to tell you how he's going to pitch a guy when he's going to lose a game, and the defense proper with that thought in mind.
So where does the manager come in if the pitcher said, this is the way I'm going to pitch him, and you disagree?
Well, let me give you an example of that. We were talking one day in the first part of a year, and Cochran was the manager.
This is the Tigers.
Yeah, and in the 30s. And there was a guy in our meeting who was on our ball club who had just played against the hitter that we didn't know. And let's say it was Morgan. Cochran would say, well, he played last year in Toledo, and you pitched against him quite a bit, Harry. What did you do? And he said, well, we tried to jam him. And Cochran said, did everybody try to jam him on your club? And he said, yes. And Cochran said, then we'll pitch away from him. And everybody laughed, and Cochran said, look, if this guy hit 350, you had to be pitching him wrong.
That's right.
So that a catcher who's been around a long time knows exactly what a pitcher can do against a hitter. Because it's happened many, many, many times. Same hitter, same pitcher. Yeah. But there comes a time when a pitcher is going to change that pattern. And if he has got the background and it's a winning run in the balance, then he has the right. He has earned the right to decide what he's going to throw. Now, it's a funny thing to say that a manager will not agree to let a guy do something he wants to do. But
I see all the time now, Bertie, where the catcher's looking, like in the World Series, the catcher's looking over the dugout, he's getting a signal from the, what they call the bench coach now, or from the manager, he's flashing it out there. It's like football. Watching the coach from the sideline, he's calling every pitch. That's quite different from what you're telling me.
Yeah, well, if they're looking in for a pitch, I think it's wrong.
Well, that's what I saw in the World Series over and over again in the playoff.
Well, you might have been looking for a pitch, but it could also have been for a pitch out.
Okay.
To set up a situation.
Okay.
The difference between the pitch out now and in the old days, and this is too bad, that a hitter doesn't get the right to put on his own hit and run. Lupe Appling was famous, and nobody could ever figure out his hit and run. The catchers would talk to each other about Luke, and talk to each other. And I said to him one time, Luke, let me ask you a question. what was your hit and run sign? And he said, with most of them, I just said, you run and I'll hit.
Keep it simple.
Yeah, so that you had to remember when you were going to pitch out. And you had to try to get the batter's sign. And you had to get... I just believe that in the case of a hit and run, if they have the sign, mm-hmm. yes. But I don't see any reason for pitching out when the guy's not running.
Yep.
That only says to me that a pitcher is out there and he's saying to himself, I'm going to pitch this guy low and away, and I'm going to try to give him a little crossfire, and all of a sudden the catcher puts down the pitch out. And the pitcher knows it comes from the bench, so he pitches out. And now he gets his concentration back and says, I can't pitch that guy that way now. I'm behind. So I've got to do this. And what you're doing, and I'm only talking about baseball as the way it should be mm-hmm. played. What you're doing is you're destroying the concentration of the pitcher.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. When a pitcher is thinking a certain way, I always said that there was never a pitcher that I caught that I couldn't hit. And I proved it.
Really?
When I was, yes.
How'd you prove it?
I knew what he was thinking. I knew it. I caught him. And I caught him the way he wanted to pitch.
You mean there's a certain rhythm
a
or
report.
A pattern of pitches?
A guy can only pitch a certain way.
You mean the body movement?
Well,
or the kind of pattern of fastball stuff?
I just know that if a pitcher is thinking I'm going to pitch this guy high and the catcher calls for a curveball, then one of them is wrong.
Yes.
And if the catcher keeps calling the pitch when the pitcher wants to throw the curveball and he calls for the fastball, The catcher is the pitcher is going to step back. And if the game has been successfully operated, mm-hmm. then nothing is said. But all of a sudden, the catcher gets hurt, or the catcher is given a day's rest, and another guy goes in there to catch him. And every time he thinks fastball, he gets the fastball sign. Well, you know that he's going into the manager and say, hey, the next time I pitch, I'd like to pitch to birdie.
Yeah.
And it's pretty hard for a manager to not allow that. It's also impossible for him to let them do that when the guy he's got catching him is a strength.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are great pitchers, and I can think of one in Philadelphia who would only pitch to McCarver. McCarver won before he caught him, and the guy won after he caught him,
mm-hmm.
but he just felt comfortable with mm-hmm. McCarver. I'm positive that McCarver could have walked up against him and hit him, because he was in tune. He was absolutely in tune with that guy.
Mm-hmm. So they really
so
had.
That's what I meant when I said that.
But how about you know? Let's go back to your days. Using some of those thoughts when you went up with Cleveland as manager in 54, I believe.
Right.
Stayed with them until about August of 58.
Right.
Now, you had a powerhouse of a team.
Yes,
I mean, you had guys slugging that baseball all over the place.
We broke the record. Yeah.
Well, you tied the New York Giant record of, what, 220?
212.
220, wasn't it? Until the Yankees broke it in 1961, which I think is 240 or 241. But anyway.
Yeah, I think I have a ring that they gave us, and the ring says...
212?
I don't know.
Okay, whatever.
212,
you know, 212 or 220, yeah. I mean, that's a lot of home runs.
Yeah, I don't know where the ring is in the vault.
Oh. There, you know, your teams were known as hitting teams rather than pitching teams. And, you know, you came close to winning the pennant. You were manager of the year one of those years. So here you had Kulusevski, you had Crow came up, George Crow, you had Wally Post, Gus Bell, Frank Robinson came up under your tutelage. Was the question then, how am I going to handle all these sluggers and give them a chance and make them feel comfortable as opposed to worrying about your pitching staff? So well, then you have to concentrate then more on
your... You know, when you're managing, it's kind of like you're in a card game and they deal you a hand and you have to play the cards that are dealt to you.
You had no choice about who you're going to have on the team?
Not when you get there. When I walked out of Indianapolis into Cincinnati, do you think change Klazuski or Temple? I gave Temple a chance he would not have otherwise gotten, but McMillan is the best fielding shortstop I ever saw.
Yeah.
And the ball club's philosophy was built around power. The ballpark was designed for power. And therefore, all you needed in that case was a closer, a great closer. And the 1 year that I had the great closer, we went into the last 3 days of it with a chance to win it.
Yeah.
And I don't believe there was ever a better closer than Herschel Freeman. I saw him pitch in Louisville, and we got a chance to get him, and we got him. And his career was so short because, unfortunately, he hurt his arm. And in those days, there was no medical means that we knew of to take care of the arm in Herschel.
Mm-hmm.
Herschel just lost a lot of velocity, and he couldn't do the job. But there was never anybody better than him. And as a result, all I had to do was get myself into the sixth inning, seventh inning, and eighth or ninth inning or whenever, and do like they do now. We've lost our train of thought. When that alarm went off,
uh-huh.
Boom.
Boom.
That's like a pitcher looking in there, and he's thinking, I can get and strike him out with this. That ball in here, mm-hmm. You get the other pitch.
Well,
let me first explain about a manager. There's no book written for managers.
That's right.
You can describe what Stengel did. Mm-hmm. You can describe what Lopez did, and both of them are opposite types of managers. Or Cochran or McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that seems constant about managers is that they have their own coaches. They keep their coaches unless the coaches go on to become managers.
Hello.
Hi. Don't get up. How you doing? Glad to see you.
How are you?
Hope you're feeling better.
Oh, it's so stupid. I thought it was time to exit.
Wonderful. I would love to have some.
Okay, managing.
Yes, you're talking about the different personalities.
Yeah, you play the cards that they deal you. If you have a club that runs, you let them run. And if you have a club that's powerful, you get them in a position where they can use their power.
Mm-hmm.
That means that some of the guys on the ball club have to sacrifice themselves to get the big man up. They criticized the guy in Gene Mark,
mm-hmm.
in Minnesota for bunting. And Jim Leland does it all the time. Mm-hmm. He's got the shortstop, and every time the shortstop is up, they know he's mm-hmm. going to bunt. And it works because he gets Bonds and Bonilla mm-hmm. and all those guys up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he didn't have a second batter who could mm-hmm. do that, then he would play the game just a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
I'm giving credit where credit is due with this great manager, Leland. He recognizes that that's the way he has to play. If you gave him the ball club I had, and he might do the same thing. He might bunt to get a Bell, who was one of the most consistent hitters I've ever seen,
mm-hmm.
or Klazuski up to the plate, or Wally Post. And certainly you would try to avoid a double play. You'd mm-hmm. use a hit and run. And you just let the ball players play and do what they can do best.
But that means that a manager has got to be insightful to know what they can do best.
That's right, and you can't do it in a broadcasting booth where you don't know these things. All they give you is 100 stats.
Well, yeah, you could.
And they put out all of the ifs and the buts, and no, you've got to know your men. You've got to know what they did, how they reacted.
Well, you just keep that in your head. I mean, you didn't have calculators and computers in those days. I guess you had charts that you...
Yeah, we had charts. We had... if you ran into trouble, I can remember one time we could not get the first baseman for the Baltimore Orioles. We couldn't get Boog Powell out, and so I told my general manager that we're having a lot of trouble getting this guy out. I'd like to have somebody go out and take a look at him, maybe help us. Well, he sent one of our scouts in to look at Powell play 6 games. And when we came in, he was waiting for me, and he's a great big guy that hits the ball 9 miles. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that you don't want him to do is to turn on a ball on you. And we didn't have a 90-mile-per-hour pitcher. So he said, Bertie, just pitch the ball in on him and play him with your infield as though he were a right-hand pull hitter. And I looked at him. I said, you got to be kidding. And he said, no, I'm not kidding. And he'll hit the ball at the second baseman or the shortstop if the ball is high in on him, mm-hmm. and in on him. Mm-hmm. But he'll pull anything from the middle of the plate out, and he had 9 miles. So I had a pitcher, Dick Donovan, who had great control. And I told Dick what had been told to me, and he said, well, I'll give it a try. And the first time Boog was up, he was in a position where he could hurt us. And Donovan pitched him inside, and he hit the ball right at the second baseman. And the next time up, he hit the ball right at the second baseman. And it was just one of those things that it was unbelievable that a man as big and strong as he was could be pitched in the position where his power should be. And that's one of the reasons why a guy out in advance helps. But he should only be out in advance and help where you needed help. You don't need help when you got the guy from Boston pitching. You know, you don't need help with Morris pitching. You might need help with one hitter for Morris, and not for a whole ball club or somebody out there that doesn't...
When you went to, well, let me see, when you went up to Cincinnati, you took the place of one fantastic Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
Rodgers Hornsby.
Yeah.
And you did some, going back to that point, that you can be a Hall of Famer, but that doesn't mean you're going to be a successful manager. And you took a club out of second division, and in 2 years, almost winning the pennant.
Well, I you know, that's one of the things.
So
I didn't take a club. I managed the club.
Well.
And the ball players took us. You know.
Maybe you're being too modest, Bertie.
No, I'm not being modest. In 1956, we had a chance to win it. And we went out and got help. And it got us into the final week of the season. And when the season was over, and we had drawn $1.2 million, and they had never drawn over $600,000, and everything was great. I spent half of my winter wondering what I could have done to make up the difference between winning and losing. I didn't know whether the ball club finished where it did in spite of me or because of me.
And over that winter, what'd you come up with?
I came up with a blank. I couldn't find out where we could have done anything different than what we did. We
Well, your pitching staff was Nexall, who was 13-11. Johnny Klepstein, 12-11. Herb Hirsch Freeman, 14-5. Fantastic relief.
Yeah, that's the guy I'm talking about.
And a fellow by the name of Lawrence.
The Bull Lawrence, he won about 20 games.
Yeah, 19-10.
That's right.
But, you know, you were up against the Dodgers. Don Newcomb, Sal Magley, Carl Erskine, Roger Craig. The Braves had Warren Spahn.
Wait a minute. They had I don't know when Joe Black was over with the Dodgers, but they had Joe Black.
Yeah, I don't remember. Yeah, that's right.
And they had Clem Levine was an outstanding reliever.
So your team was against some powerhouse of pitching staffs.
Oh, Milwaukee.
Yeah, you had Spahn, you had
Burdette. Burdette would beat me five times a year.
Bob Buell?
Buell never pitched against us.
Oh.
Buell was a very effective guy against the clubs that Milwaukee had to beat.
And, but they say pitching, that goes the old adage, pitching is the name of the game, no matter if you can hit 220 home runs a year.
Pitching is the name of a game. If you use it properly, you can abuse a pitching staff. You can. I hate to say that in 1956 we lost because of our pitching. Our guys, they were so great. They were happy. They did anything that you want them to do. They pitched whenever they were asked to pitch. I can't say that these guys, some of them were not pitchers, but I remember a meeting that Mr. Crosley had. He was the owner of the ball club with me and Gabe Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very interested in whether we could win or not, and he said, "I'm not happy about the way your pitching is going, Bertie." And I said, "Well, neither am I." But I said, "They'll be all right. We'll make it." And he said, "What about your pitching coach?" And I suddenly froze because my pitching coach was Tom Ferrick. And he was making every one of these guys better than they were. And they loved him. And I said, "Mr. Crosley, Tom Ferrick doesn't tell these guys what to do. I do. If there's anything wrong with the pitching staff, don't blame Ferrick. Blame me."
Mm-hmm.
And I got up and walked out of the room. Now, what I'm doing is blowing my job. Who owns the ball club? And I was in his home with Gabe Paul, and I waited in Gabe's car, and he came out and he saw the car, and we started to drive back to the city. And I said, "Well, Gabe, come on, what did he say? Am I fired?" And he said, "No, he told me to tell you that you shouldn't tell everybody how good you are. We already know it." And we both started to laugh, and we both learned a big lesson about a great man. But if Tom Ferrick were handling the pitching now, he would have the same reputation that they're giving some of the great pitching coaches who are now working. So it's a matter of time. My ball club did the best they could. They had super years. The pitching was good. I made a mistake. I had a great relief pitcher after Freeman. His name was Klipstein, Johnny mm-hmm. Klipstein. And I talked to him about relieving, and he said that he couldn't warm up that fast. Now, Johnny wanted to pitch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I thought then that he couldn't relieve, and just before I left and before John left, I started him to relieve some. I think he would have been one of the real great relievers.
What happened to him?
Well, he just fitted that mold. But there are guys who are relievers who, for some mechanical reason, cannot start. The trouble that they inherit, they can take care of. And the trouble that they cause, they can't take care of.
What do you mean, the trouble they cause?
Well, if they start an inning off, And suddenly, a base on ball and a base hit, and you got a man on first and third and one man out. Some guys are not equipped to handle that situation where your closer can come in and strike him out. That's pretty much what I meant.
Okay.
They inherit a guy's troubles and do a great job, and when they get their own troubles, it doesn't give them the incentive that they had, I guess. I'm only talking on the top of my head, but that's the way I feel. And Eggersley is a pretty good example. I go over reports I wrote about Eggersley when he was with the starter for the Red Sox, and when I look at the writing on the report, you can almost see where he should have been a relief pitcher. If you, 20 years or 15 years later, weren't privileged to look back, you'd say that somebody made a mistake instead of... And when you're talking about relief pitchers, you have to get into a situation where you need them. What good is Eckersley if you're not tied or one run in front? He's just another guy on your staff.
Yeah, that's right.
That makes him great. Otherwise, he would be very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about every guy who's a great, great closer. You've got to get them in that position to prove that they're great. And
But that's a risky chance.
That's a job of managing.
I know that's a risky chance. You know, it can't be just by trial and error that you find who's the person that can really be that closer.
Well, he belongs to you.
I know, you feel a part.
You know him. You know how he feels. He's part of your staff.
You know his attitude about what it is to have a man on first and third and one out and come in?
Yeah, sure you do.
You can tell that in their eyeballs?
No, I'm not talking about courage or anything like that. I'm just talking about the kind of stuff that a guy has. We have guys pitching now that I call no-brainers. And the reason I call it is because I want to describe a guy who takes the ball, looks into the plate, gets a sign, which he doesn't need because he's going to throw a fastball.
He'll throw a fastball anyway.
Winds up and kicks his leg high in the air and picks up home plate at the last instant of relief on a 94-mile-per-hour fastball. And you don't have a hitter standing in that plate that's got the guts to hang in there. I don't care who he is. And that's what I mean by a closer. That's what I mean by a no-brainer. That's the difference between a starting pitcher and a closing pitcher. The ability to come in and do everything wrong and get away with it. But if they came in the first inning, about the third, somebody would hit a ball through the box, a swinging bunt, a couple of base on balls. They'd weigh against them, but not in the situation where you need them.
Frank Robinson came up as a rookie when you were manager, what, 1957?
I think Frank Robinson is, you know, I think that a great ball player is a great ball player.
Well, but some develop it.
You're going to say it, but I'm going to say that it isn't fair to say that DiMaggio is the greatest when you think about Mays, or that Mays is the greatest when you think about Aaron. And then you put Frank Robinson in that group because he has to be in it. I think he's the most underrated great ball player that has been around in my memory. And he came to me out of high school.
Yeah, he was, what, 19 years old?
I don't remember his age, but he was young, and he had to acclimate himself to the major leagues, which he did. He had to learn all of the things that go with becoming a major league ball player, which he did. And he's a very smart man. Frank Robinson is a bright guy.
So what did you do as a manager? Here you got a kid, you see this potential. He comes up, and you got a powerhouse of a lineup anyway.
Yeah, well, I think he hit 38 home runs one year for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have anything to do with a guy like Frank Robinson. I just try to get him up there in the right place at the right time. Frank Robinson could run. He could run fast. The only thing that he didn't do above average was throw. And that, of all the tools that a ball player needs, that's the one way he can be very weak in and have it not affect.
And still get by with it. Yeah, if he can run and bat.
Most overrated tool of them all is an arm, throwing arm.
Most overrated?
Yeah.
Get a guy, I don't think I'd hear that from a catcher.
Well, we get a guy in St. We get a guy in St. Louis named Coleman. He's no longer with St. Louis. Mm-hmm. But he leads the league in assists every year. Mm-hmm. And he can't throw, but he's got artificial turf to throw on.
Yeah.
And he throws the ball into the artificial turf, and it gets there faster, and they run on him because they know he can't throw. And so he does a great job.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of his arm.
When Robinson came up, I heard stories that he had a very unusual batting stance, that he would crowd the plate and lean his, in fact, he'd lean his body over it, and he got hit a lot. You ever try to correct him on that? Hey, push back a little bit?
That would be like telling Teddy Williams that he ought to go into a crouch.
Okay. Okay. No, I get the point.
Yeah, you let the man play. He ran into a slump, or he ran into some difficulty, you would attack that problem. If it were in his hitting,
mm-hmm.
I remember watching Klosowski, whom I think should be in the Hall of Fame. Nobody ever gives that big guy credit for. He was the best guy fielding a ball in the dirt at first base that I ever saw. And because he came out of Cincinnati, there's no reason why he should be overlooked in the Hall of Fame picture.
So you're saying the big cities like...
Well, they're going to have a lot of guys coming up soon that have played first base, and I think Klosowski should be right there, regardless of what the writers thought of. You know, he was playing when there were some good first basemen. So
you say that when you came up as manager, this was the hand you were dealt. Here are the players you had in 1954. You bring them up, you get them out of second division, they are pennant contenders. Now, in 1957, 3 years later, you or Gabe Paul or somebody begins trading them away. Ted Klosowski went to the Pirates. I think you got Don Hope from the Cubs, and Wally Post went up to the Phillies for Harvey Haddix.
We got Perky for a left-handed pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly didn't do anything in dealing any ball player that we thought would hurt them or us. I think that's one of the things that a ball player doesn't really understand, that you don't deal him to hurt him, and the club that's getting him doesn't take him to relieve you of a problem. Everybody thinks they're doing the right thing, and sometimes the ball player that you get doesn't fit into the picture of your ball club. It's a type of balance thing. You don't have to have many more than two great ball players to have a great ball club, if you get the right guy surrounding those two ball players. And there are teams now where the draft has created a weakness, and we don't have the discipline hitting. We have everything in baseball as good or better than it was, except for the hitting. Time and time and time again, we see guys striking at low outside sliders, and their balls, and
Saw it in the World Series and playoffs all over again.
But
might as well have had a shovel trying to hit that thing.
Right. Well, the great hitter won't swing at that ball.
Yeah, but the umpire is calling a lot of them, too. And so they're tempted
to call it because it's a strike, and they don't call it when it's a ball. And now one guy might have a strike zone that's a little wider than the next guy, but he has it for everyone.
Yeah, it's so consistent.
Yeah, as long as he's consistent. I remember a guy taking a strike one time, and Charlie Burry was umpiring, and Charlie took the batter. Billy Hitchcock was the batter, and he took a pitch, and Charlie called it a strike three. And Billy went, "Oh no!" And he said, "Billy, don't take any pitches that close again on me. I'm not that good an umpire." And I thought that this guy was better than anybody else.
But you must admit, though, Bertie, that your big-time hitters, your stars, your Teddy Williams...
They get four strikes.
That's right.
Sure they do.
I always heard the old story that Ted Williams would take a pitch, and the umpire would say, "Oh, if he took a pitch, it must be a ball. Yeah. Somebody else do it, strike."
I'm not doing this for the tape, but... I told Bill McGowan, who was umpiring one day in Boston, and I was catching for Detroit. I went up to home plate, and I said, "Bill, I'm going to tell you something." I said, "This Williams is taking pitches that are strikes." And he said, "No, he's not." And I said, "All you guys don't have enough guts to call strike three on the guy." And... he told me where to go and what to do, and Williams got up, and there was a pitch with two strikes. I don't know how we got the two strikes on him, but it was an inch or two outside, you know. And he said, "Strike three, you're out." And Williams turned around and looked at him, and he said, "Bill, it won't happen again, you son of a bitch." He looked at me. And that's what, when you mentioned that,
brought back the memory of that.
A memory of that. Strike three and it won't happen again.
Rose's manager.
Pete Rose.
No, I'm sorry, not Pete Rose. R-O-L-E-S. Did you, as a manager, have to be a public relations with the press? Did you hold many press conferences? Did you have to? Did you feel obligated? That's a big role of a manager today.
Well,